Batch Boy.
Overlooking Phoenix. From high above in the Star Worldwide Network studios, Batch Boys. Stories, insight, guests, and true blue humor with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. And now, here they are, the Badge Boys.
Welcome back to another edition of the Badge Boys, the show where two cops talk to the community. I'm retired Crime Stopper Sergeant Darren Birch.
I'm retired Phoenix Police Officer Jason Schechterly.
And this edition of Badge Boys, we have a story like no other. You all know the holiday classic, It's a Wonderful Life, the Frank Capra film that captures everybody's hearts during the holiday season with Jimmy Stewart's character falling on hard times. And I won't go too much into the story, but he loses his family, he loses his friends, he loses his life, he loses everything. This is a law enforcement version of that story, except we have hookers, we have murder hookers, and we have a cop. He is the prime suspect in her murder. It is a riveting story, and I can't wait for you to listen to Larry Averick. He was a former San Diego Police Department officer, now private investigator, and author of Who Killed Donna Gentile? The Real Story. So we'll have that. Then we go into cop talk. Then we have, of course, our stupid suspect stories galore. We have Jason's inspirational close. So stay tuned, stay informed, and most of all, you're going to be entertained.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Batch Boys. We'll be back right after this.
I remember the moment.
I'll never forget that moment.
As long as I live.
As long as I live.
Several of us were working to rescue a family.
The house collapsed on top of the cellar door and trapped them.
We had to use Humvees and heavy machinery to move massive trees and debris.
We got them out.
We helped a lot of people out.
It felt good to know I could really make a difference.
Because I'm a citizen soldier in the National Guard.
Be there the moment your community needs you. Learn more at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Arizona National Guard. Aired by the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
Move over, AZ. Arizona's move over law requires you to move over or slow down when you drive past any vehicle pulled over with flashing lights. Remember, every vehicle, every time. Move over, AZ.
Sponsored by ADOT in partnership with the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to Badge Boys with retired Police Sergeant Darren Birch and retired Police Officer Jason Schechterly. Now, back to the Badge Boys.
You know, I am so excited about our next guest. This is a riveting story. I remember in the 80s, I was a cop in the 80s, and I remember this coming to light, hearing a lot of the bad stuff. And now that I know the true story, the full story, I can't help but equate it to that holiday classic, It's a Wonderful Life. And Jason, are you familiar with that film?
Oh, of course.
Everyone is.
Everybody better be familiar with that film because it is a wonderful life, and the holidays would not be what they are without watching that. So,
yeah, it's a great story for those who don't know. I was living under a rock. It's basically a good, humble person who falls on horrible times. He loses family, friends, job, livelihood. He loses it all and wants to commit suicide. And then it ends in a very sweet, loving way. A true Christmas story. This next story kind of is like that, except, like I said, this is filled with hookers. It's filled with a murder hooker. It is police corruption. And it all starts with this humble, good cop who's trying to cultivate a CI, like a lot of us did back in the day. And I know I did when I was on the bike squad and undercover and so forth, always cultivating CIs and so forth. And it goes horribly wrong. Before I introduce you to our guest, former San Diego police officer Larry Averick, I want to play a clip for you that will kind of get you up to speed, and here that is.
The 43 victims were women, most of them prostitutes, a few were hitchhikers. Their bodies were found months, even years after they disappeared. Complicating the investigation were rumors that police officers might have been involved in a murder or two.
I can state flatly that no police officers were involved in the murder of any prostitutes.
The most high-profile victim was Donna Gentile, a prostitute and police informant. For years, rumors persisted that some San Diego police officers had a hand in her murder. When her friend Cynthia Main disappeared, there were more questions about cops. But the task force says this man killed Gentile and perhaps her friend. Ronald Porter is already serving time for killing another woman in the same series of murders.
The evidence we have would certainly preclude us from prosecuting anyone else. So your question is well taken, but are we about to charge him? No, not at this time.
The task force says Porter may be responsible for 13 of the unsolved murders and that there may never be enough evidence to prosecute him on any of them.
But because of the circumstances surrounding her death, people in the community and the press have assumed or suspected that maybe police officers were responsible for her killing. And that's been going on for years and years and years. By naming Mr. Porter as a suspect, it kind of takes a monkey off their back, and very conveniently.
The DA praised the task force, calling it the most effective agency of its kind in the country. By phone, a former sheriff's investigator disagrees.
I think to accept that task force is the most successful task force in the country is an absurd statement.
Streed, one of the original members of the task force, was yanked from the agency. He says the San Diego Police Department got involved in the murder investigations for only one reason, damage control.
Well, there certainly was an indication in the course of that investigation of motives to cover up. I had contacted police officers that were told that if they were caught talking to me, they would lose their jobs.
The task force says 26 of the 43 murders are now solved. The five-year effort is winding down for good. Liz Purcell, News 8.
Yeah, that was riveting, right? And now we have, without further ado, I want to introduce you, again, former San Diego police officer Larry Averick. Larry, thank you for joining our show.
Oh, you're welcome.
Now, again, in the beginning, I kind of talked about you are an author. You wrote the book, Who Killed Donna Gentile? The real story, because there's a lot, well, there's other books out there, and unfortunately, they kind of cater to the false narrative that a lot of media and, quite frankly, police aren't put out. Can you talk about how you came involved with Donna and where you were that day that really your life kind of spiraled out of control?
Well, originally, back in 1981, I was still on probation after the academy, and they were short a man working south of the interstate, and they came to me and said, do you want to work that area? And I lived there. I know it like the back of my hand, and I said, yeah, sure. So it was just fate that somebody didn't show up for work that put me in that place.
Go ahead. You saw Donna as she was talking to someone that you know. Tell me about that.
Well, I didn't. After the ride along, there was an investigation, and I was cleared. But 3.5 years later, on a traffic stop, I see her talking with an individual who turns out to be my current wife's ex-fiancé.
Talking to a hooker.
Yeah, and he always told her that he would never have to pay for it. He could always get it free.
And yeah, they're usually the ones that pay for it.
I chuckled when I saw that, and I just said, boy, wait till she hears about this.
And this was your wife at the time you were talking about, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. So tell me what happened then.
Well, he takes off. I get his information. And I said to Donna, I said, what's his problem? And she said, oh, he's a trick. So that just confirmed my suspicion. And she said that she was tired of being harassed by police, but she had a lieutenant in her hip pocket, and it was going to end very soon.
And what did you do with that information?
Well, suspecting that there might be some corruption going on because I later found out that it was my lieutenant who was supposed to be in charge of the prostitution enforcement detail. And instead of eradicating the problem, he was adding to it. And I befriended her in an effort to develop information that I could turn over.
And so you end up meeting her because she ended up kind of taking off and she said where she was at so you could meet. And you were there to get intel to find out if there was some type of corruption going on. But that wasn't her plans, was it?
No. Donna was for Donna and whatever she could get out of people, she did. She used people and she used my lieutenant, matter of fact.
And she wanted to use you that night, right?
Correct. She told me that she would tell me who the person was if I went over after shift. So I went over there. I wanted to find out if the information was true, I could do something with it. If it wasn't true, I could let the squad and everybody know that she's out there trying to burn a cop and, you know, just steer clear.
And what happened then?
Well, she tried to tempt me. She had came to answer the door in a red teddy and asked me in, and I said, no, I'll just stay right here. And it was a cat and mouse game. So I just said, look, I'm out of here. Started walking down the stairs, and at that point, she yelled out my lieutenant's name.
Wow. And that's the first time you realized it was your lieutenant. And tell us about the photograph.
Well, the following day, I had made contact with her. Rather than chasing around on the streets, I asked her that night for a phone number, and because I wanted to get whatever information she had. And the following day, she tells me she's going to the Colorado River with other members of the department and their girlfriends and wives, and that she was basically set up for one of the lieutenant's sergeant friends.
So basically, she was the sex for the trip.
Right, and I didn't believe her at first, but I started checking things. I looked in the computer. She wasn't stopped during that period of time when she said she was going to be gone. I checked the jail. She wasn't in jail. Consequently, when she got back, she telephoned me, told me about the trip, said she was with that sergeant, that they had sex, that pictures were taken. And I said, oh, I'd like to see the pictures. And I could go somewhere and tell anybody, you know, hey, this is what I was told, but a picture painted 1,000 words.
Oh, it's just hearsay.
And
absolutely.
I wanted to get my hands on that so that I had definite proof. And unfortunately, I was never able to do that. She decided that, wait a minute, he's not falling for my temptations. I have no control over him. I'm telling him everything that's going to burn my money connection, so I've got to go in a different direction.
And what direction was that?
Well, she went to Internal Affairs and with trumped-up charges against me.
What were the charges? They investigated.
They said that I had sex with her on several occasions, that it was at her her apartment, that it was out in the field, that during a period of time when I was working backup to a vice detail, that I had an undercover car and pulled up, told her that it would go easier on her if she got in the car and we went to some location and had sex. And that couldn't be further from the truth, because what she didn't know was the fact that we have policies and procedures, and you don't just, patrolman doesn't just take out an unmarked vehicle. He has to go through the investigative lieutenant and sign it out on a clipboard that's in his office, and it has to be approved. So not knowing that, she came out with something that that she really couldn't back up.
And you could disprove.
But at the same time, yeah. At the same time, my department knew this, and yet they looked the other way.
And they end up believing, on a he said, she said, if you will, they end up believing her.
Right.
Tell us about that.
And I couldn't figure out why. I suspected maybe she had some in with the department, but that wasn't proven until later. So I could only allege it until I met a deputy DA that told me that was in fact the truth.
And before we get into that, she testified against you, and then how many days later did she end up dead?
Well, she testified in May of 85 at my civil service hearing, and there she recanted most of her allegations, or she couldn't remember what she had originally said. And nevertheless, the city terminated me anyway. And it was June 23rd that they found her body. She was actually killed 24 hours before.
Can we back up for a second, Larry? Because I'm confused, so I know the audience has to be confused. When you, two things, when you left her apartment that night trying to get that info and the cat and mouse game, and she screamed out your lieutenant's name, what did that infer? That he was there and she was calling him out so he could come?
No. No, I was starting to leave and go down the steps, and because she wouldn't tell me who it was.
She was talking about Lieutenant.
Oh, then she screamed. Okay, so then when she had these trumped up charges against you, you just said a few minutes ago that you weren't sure why the department was believing her, but you knew that your lieutenant, she knew his name. So where did those wires cross?
Well, he had been, like I said, there was a relationship that they had in addition to the one that she was carrying on with me.
Right. So I'm saying when IA was interviewing you, why didn't you, like, did you want to tell them the lieutenant's name and say,
oh,
hey.
I did.
Oh, okay.
I did.
Okay.
They called me in. They told me what the charges were, and they said, do you have anything else to say? And that's when I told them.
Okay.
So now she ends up dead. They look at you as a suspect because she was basically making allegations against you. Your lieutenant is still lieutenant, but later he loses his job. Tell us about how that unfolded.
Well, prior to her death, when he was investigated, he originally got 10 days off. I wasn't privy to his specific investigation other than I knew that he got the 10 days. And then when they found out there was additional information that he didn't come forward with in his investigation with internal affairs, that's when they decided to fire him. But I don't even think the ink was dry. He went and asked for a chief's interview, and whatever was said behind closed doors got him his job back, but at a reduced rank.
So he gets his job back. The prostitute is dead. You're out of the job, and you're prime suspect number one. What happens then?
Well, I lost my house. Prior to losing my house, I had a comic book business that was supporting me because I had to use up all my retirement funds that they gave me to keep the house going. And Internal Affairs, even after my termination, continued to contact my ex-wife, not my current wife, but my ex-wife, and basically said, you need to see an attorney and get your kids taken away from them because terrible things
seriously?
Are going to happen to them.
Wow.
And
then how
I
about
said,
you? Oh, go ahead, please.
You know, was he a mind reader? How would he know what was going to happen to me? And so basically, I didn't have anything to fight with. I didn't have money to get an attorney to keep the kids, and they wound up getting taken away from me.
And so you lost your kids. You're struggling to keep your house. How about your wife? Did she stand by you?
My wife was present wife at the time was a brittle diabetic. Her parents lived in town, and she couldn't put up with the stress. And she just said, I got to leave.
Wow.
So she went back and lived with her parents. And I shortly followed thereafter. But, you know, it was from good, it went to extremely rocky.
So now, I don't want to speed this up, but were you ever charged with the murder? Were you ever interviewed for it? You're just with that.
I was interviewed over the telephone by Tom Street, who was the investigator in the case for the sheriff's department. She was found out in the county, so it was the sheriff's department.
Yeah, well, having worked in homicide for a few years, my favorite subject matter, what were the details of her murder?
They found her badly beaten body. Her neck was broken. Her back was broken in three places. She was nude. Her clothes were piled on top of her body, and as I said, it sat there overnight. She had been murdered on the 22nd, and
beaten. No weapons. They don't know what she was beaten with, or nothing found at the scene.
No.
Okay.
Nothing found at the scene. No weapons. The sheriff's department, I find out later, one of the people was dyslexic and had all the measurements and distances and everything followed up, and they had to go back and reinvestigate.
That's bizarre.
That never came out in the papers.
What never came out in the papers?
The fact that they had blown the investigation to start with.
Gosh, as far as measurements and so forth. So now what happens? Time goes on. No one knows who killed Donna Gentile. What happens?
Well, back in November of 85, my ex-wife typed up a letter to 60 Minutes to Mike Wallace and sent it in. And they dispatched one of their reporters out to talk with me. And the remark that Lowell Bergman said was, sounds like San Diego's up to their old tricks. We're going to have to go out and see what's what. So they sent him out. I talked with him. He gave me the name of a newspaper reporter in San Diego that I could trust. And from there, it was just a series of dots that got connected. I went and met the reporter. The reporter said, it's not we don't believe you, but will you take a polygraph? I said, yes, but I can't afford it. He said, that's all right. The paper will pay for it. So they had somebody that they had used for other cases. As it turned out, he was a former homicide investigator from San Bernardino, and he tested me twice and passed. And a few months later, he goes out to dinner with one of his old bosses, and it turned out that that was Richard Lewis from the DA's office. He had quit the sheriff's department, where he worked homicide and criminal intelligence, and he was able to fill me in on a lot of the shenanigans that my department was pulling.
So he reached out to you?
Yes, yeah. After the dinner, the polygrapher called me and said, I've got somebody that is willing to talk to you about your case. He knows a lot about it. Would you be willing to talk to him? And I said, sure. So when he called, he said, you don't have a sour grape story. I know a lot about your case, and I can tell you right now you were set up and I can prove it. And I just said, I'll be your best friend. What do you need? I've got arrest reports. I got shake slips. I've got everything, you know. And he said, right now, I just want you to come down and talk with me. So from there, he looked at my entire internal affairs case and had their people number stamp it and put it in order for me. He thought I had a good chance of going back on the department and help me with the writing of my claim against the city. You know, I said, even if I was able to get back, I think I'd have a target on my back. They could fire me for having a brown sock and a black sock. And he said, you know, that's true. So I didn't pursue that. I pursued the lawsuit against the city, but I was forced again to, they just hit me with so much paper. I didn't have an attorney. Couldn't find an attorney that would take the case. It was either I would never oppose Chief Colander, he's a close personal friend of mine, or I would need $50,000 up front, no guarantees, to start. And so, you know, I just had doors closing in every direction. I went out of San Diego, looked in Los Angeles, still couldn't find anybody that would be willing to take the case.
So everything's going bad, even though the assistant DA knows you're innocent.
Yes.
And the book that you wrote, which, by the way, is a wonderful, well-written book, Who Killed Donna Gentile? It talks about who killed her. Talk about that. How'd that come about?
Well, that came about, I figured that I had to, in order to clear my name, I had to find out who killed her. So in October of 1988, which was a month after the Metropolitan Homicide Task Force was put together, they arrested Ronald Elliott Porter for an attempted murder of Annette Russell. And when they showed his face on TV, there's two things that I do very well. One is remember license plates, and the other one is faces. So I remembered that I had seen him at a 7-Eleven store in the 5200 block of Balcone Boulevard, which is one of the places that Donna would frequent just to get off the street and away from cops. So with that information, I went to Registrar of Voters, found out that I pulled his card, and found out that he lives less than a tenth of a mile from that store, walking distance. And in the meantime, the only information that the homicide had at the time was that he lived in Escondido, 30 miles away, when he actually lived with his mother at that location. So in during this period of time, I'm talking with Lewis, and we're just kind of brainstorming, you know, who would be a person sufficient to be able to break somebody's back. And I just said, well, you know, either a wrestler or a bouncer type, maybe somebody trained in martial arts, or a trained killer, somebody that's in the armed forces. So from that, and the information that I had with Porter, and the fact that necks were broken in the same fashion for the other victims.
And was the other victims prostitutes?
Some were and some weren't. They originally called it the prostitute murder series.
Okay.
But there were housewives. There were wives of servicemen that had no criminal records, and they were murdered by other individuals.
Gotcha.
But
so you're putting together the aspect that this guy may have a background that relates to physical capability of breaking her back. Go ahead.
Right. So I give this to Lewis in January of 89, and he sets up an interview with the task force. They sent two officers, and both of them were from our department. It was a combined sheriff's, police, and district attorney at one time, and then they added members of the attorney general's office to it. But so at that time, they came out to interview me, and I handed them a copy of the original that I had. And they looked at me, and they said, where did you get this? And I said, never mind, it's just a piece off. So nothing from the time in January 14th of 89 until Lewis became, he was actually the third person to lead the Metropolitan Homicide Task Force. And he went in October of 90. The task force issued a report in February of 90, more than a year after I gave their investigators information. And this went out not only to the press, but it went out to the sheriff's department and the police department as to what the task force was doing. And at that point on their report, they said they did not have a suspect in the Gentile murder.
And
even though I had given them one in January of 89.
Yeah, you gave them a person of interest. You gave them this possible lead. Right. So what ended up coming with that lead?
Well, when Lewis finally went to the task force, he ran with that. He said, I think you're absolutely right. And as it turned out, they went steps further. They found the drill instructor that taught him the hold, with evidence from the survivors that he had. There were six attempted murders that he committed as well, and they gave a lot of information. There was a lot of evidence. In Gentile's case, they had fibers and hair and footprints and tire marks. One of the tire tracks that was left at a scene matched the tire that was one of his spare tires in the vehicle he drove.
And so what year is this that they put this together?
Well, they're putting this together from 90 forward, because they hadn't even, I mean, they may have looked at him, but apparently they had dismissed him at that point. And it wasn't until, like I said, Lewis got there in October of 90 when things started happening.
Gotcha. And was he arrested?
He was arrested for the murder of Sandra Swick. And what they were seeing was happening was a lot of the other murders that were occurring from other suspects, despite the fact that they would have four cases against this person, they were being tossed out or they were being acquitted. They didn't get everyone to agree that he was guilty. So rather than take all the cases against Porter that they had and throw them against him and take a chance on him getting off on a technicality, that would prevent him from being ever charged again. So they realized that the conviction for Sandra Swick's murder would keep him in jail the rest of his life. They decided to close the other cases.
So now looking back, you've written this wonderful book, Who Killed Donna Gentile? Tell the audience where they can pick this book up.
It's available on my website or Amazon. My website is www.whokilleddonnagentile. It's G as in George, E-N-T-I-L-E.com. And the Amazon site is whokilleddonnagentile.com/Amazon.
Well, I hope your life now can be kind of like what Jimmy Stewart's was, and It's a Wonderful Life. I hope you have a good, thriving private investigation business. I hope you have good things happening in your life because you went through hell.
Yeah, I think I'm on the other side of it.
Good deal.
I am turning a lot of heads now.
Good, 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 good. Well, again, I can't thank you enough for being on our show. That wraps it up for our guest segment. And then after this, we're going to go into our cop talk.
Be right back, everybody.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Batch Boys. We'll be back right after this.
Move over, AZ. Arizona's move over law requires you to move over or slow down when you drive past any vehicle pulled over with flashing lights. Remember, every vehicle, every time. Move over, AZ.
Sponsored by ADA in partnership with the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
I'll never forget.
Never forget that moment.
As long as I live.
As long as I live.
My first call up ever as a member of the National Guard.
When we got to the armory, they briefed us on the wildfires. They were getting dangerously close to homes.
Helicopters were going out to drop water on the fires.
Guys in the unit were preparing for firefighting with local fire crews.
At that moment, I got my first taste of just how important the Guard is to my community.
See how the Guard can be an important part of your life at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Arizona National Guard. Aired by the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to Batch Boys with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Now, back to the Batch Boys.
Welcome back to Batch Boys, everybody, to the Cop Talk segment. And we got a couple of different topics that have both me and Darren pretty passionate about. We're going to touch a little bit on our views on civilian oversight when it comes to police work, and more specifically in cases of police brutality, things that are really going to make the headlines that don't pass what we call the headline test, make a whole lot of people uncomfortable, whether it be different people, different statuses in our communities, and certainly politicians love oversight, and they just want to make sure that something looks good on paper. Well, we're doing this. So we're going to talk a little bit about how we feel the civilian oversight goes on. And Darren, you brought up a pretty interesting statistic off the air. There's roughly 12,000 police departments in this country.
Correct.
And of those 12,000, how many have civilian oversight?
Only 150. So out of 12,000, both large and small police agencies across the country, and we have approximately almost a million police officers within those 12,000 agencies. Of those, there's only 150. Now, I will say this. Many of those are large departments who have had some type of...
Like a Los Angeles, a Philadelphia.
Exactly. Los Angeles, Philadelphia, even Nashville. Nashville just came on board in 2018, I want to say.
But when I think of... So I sat on a police board, okay, when I was... Like a use of force board, where you had to review...
Like in my shooting.
Yes.
Yes.
And I would sit there and I would review, and then you would come in and we would be free to ask you questions. And then as a board, as a panel, as a committee, whatever you want to call them, we got to make a determination on how that use of force went, not justified or unjustified as far as the law. There's county attorneys and state's attorneys. They do that. But policy and things like that. So I would also see we might have a civilian on the board. And then again, some politician or somebody else could go, oh, they have civilian oversight. But do some of these departments have strictly 100% boards full of civilians and cops aren't even allowed to look?
Exactly right. What they're looking at now, and this is, I think, is an alarming trend, but what a lot of the cities that have some type of issues within their community where there's individuals that are very passionate against police officers, that are very anti-police officers. They are really trying to create an atmosphere within their community so that the pressure is on the city councils to change the dynamic of the use of force or discipline review board for the police departments so that it's all civilian. And the problem there is a lot. There's a lot of problems with that, and that unfortunately the community doesn't understand. What they hear is transparency, which is a good thing. We all love transparency. But for example, my example of my shooting, when I went before the use of force board, you know, there was the internal investigation that they are completely separate from the criminal investigation to decide separate. Whether that homicide amounts to justifiable homicide, which a homicide, by the way, for those, and Jason knows this, and Robin, I'm sure, knows this, a homicide is nothing more than a death that's attributed to non-natural causes. For example, homicide is the umbrella category, whereas murder is a homicide, but so is suicide, so is accidental, so are all these other type of death investigations. So the use of force board looks at that homicide, whether it's a justifiable homicide, i.e. a justifiable shooting, or whether it is murder or manslaughter. That's what the criminal investigation does. The internal investigation just puts out the fact internally. Was it out of policy? Was it in policy? Was it out of policy? Keeping that in mind, when I went to use the force board, the internal affairs does their stick. They talk about how the shooting went down. They have diagrams. They have all this. And they have these diagrams. They have all this tactical information, strategic information, the nuances of the investigation of what why the officer was in that situation in the first place to individuals, police officers, who understand the dynamics of police work so that you can make a educated assessment of that investigation and also of what I'm saying as the police officer who was involved in the shooting.
People who have had the same training and understand what maybe you should or shouldn't have done based on your training. I mean, I'm the first one to always say, you know what, I wasn't there, and you can never know exactly how you would act or react in a certain situation. But if you're trained the same way as somebody else, at least you can speak to that end, like, you know, that I right from wrong. Just
exactly
black and white, plain and simple. There is right and wrong in, doesn't matter if it's law enforcement officers or civilians. And I think the cops are better equipped to make that call. I know a lot of people are going to say, well, cops protect their own. And we just got through listening in our first segment that, yes, there were a bunch of cops in San Diego way back in the 80s. Early to mid 80s who were involved in prostitution and covering up their own. And our guest suffered from that. And yes, of course, there are going to be cops who have friends and there's, you know, conflicts of interest, things like that. But I'm telling you, I will argue with anybody that that is a very, very small percentage of law enforcement. Most police officers are disgusted, angry, and want to rid their department. So, like, for example, when I worked in Phoenix, if there's a bad situation, a bad cop in Phoenix, I'm not even a fan of, you know, something happens here and they go, well, we're going to have an outside agency investigate it. No, let your own, because they want to restore their good name. They want to keep things transparent, as you said. I truly believe that. Again, of course, there's going to be some outliers. There's going to be some situations you can always talk about that, well, they're friends with so-and-so. But on the civilian side, conflicts of interest is a serious issue. And there is always a conflict of interest with somebody, whether their political beliefs, their connections through business, family, or you never know. You could put a 60-year-old civilian on the board, and you don't know what that person went through with a police officer 30 years ago, what they saw on TV over the years, and that's how they're making judgments. And that, to me, doesn't make any sense.
You put your finger on it right there when you talk about we don't know who these civilians are that are going to be on this oversight board. And what they found out from these 150 agencies, many of them, not the bulk, but many of them had to go back, completely disband the board because they're making inconsistent discipline because there was no consistency based on prior knowledge and so forth. There was a lack of impartiality. There was excessive taxpayer costs because this doesn't come cheap. My argument to this is, for example, what did you do before you were a police officer, Jason?
I worked for Arizona Public Service.
Okay, APS. I would not feel comfortable being on an APS board talking about the nuclear plant.
How to deal with the power of a yeah, nuclear plant, yeah. How to deal with electricity.
Thank you.
You don't know what you're talking about.
Exactly.
So you shouldn't be on the board.
And so having civilians be an oversight, and what you know from police work is what you saw on CSI, which as police officers we're laughing right now because we know that's a lark. We have to go to court and talk to the jury about CSI is BS. Is that there's another initials for those CSI shows and it's called BS. We have to do so much effort to re-educate a jury before we even start the trial,
right,
especially on murder and sex crimes, as Jason Wells knows. So now what are we going to do with this oversight? Now, having said all that, many of the civilian oversight across the country, these 150, some of them are well orchestrated or selected to the extent that you have prior police. You have people that are in the judicial system in terms of, you know, prior prosecution or defense attorneys, people that are knowledgeable and aware. So that would be a definite plus in terms of doing civilian. But yeah, I still have a problem with it in terms of, for example, our city council, and what I'm talking about here is in Phoenix, Arizona. We're going through this issue because of it, and really wasn't police brutality. It was based on a situation where officers were heavy handed in terms of their dialogue, you know, what they were saying and their actions in terms of a shoplifting at a Dollar General store. And so that made national news because it sounded ugly.
And we took care of it. Our chief of police stepped up and took care of that. She did an incredible job, I thought, and that officer no longer works.
And I will say this. If I was on that board, that use of force board, or in this case, disciplinary board, he would not have lost his job per me. I would have said that was absolutely inappropriate. You lost control because you were demonstrating a very agitated, profanic language, and you lost control. And that's what we want, control of these situations. So I would have disciplined them for that and the language and so forth, but not to a point of so that was example of us being tougher on our own.
Yes.
But this on Tuesday, the members of the public were able to voice their opinions both for and against having such a oversight by the city council. And dozens of people, mostly those in support of police oversight, so these are people that I'm going to call them anti-police, showed up to voice their concerns. Quote, now I'm going to read this. Quote, a lot of the people were murdered by police. They were 911 calls for support for mental health, said Maria Castro, who is the community organizer for Puente, Arizona. And basically, that's anti-police group. Any dialogue where you say police officers are murdering people for 911 calls for mental health shows her agenda,
right,
because she didn't say were killed, were homicides. She said murdered.
Right.
And to me, that shows a bias,
right,
against police officers. I think it's really clear. So that's on one side, those wanting oversight because they have a bias against police officers. Then on the other side, quote, there's a war on cops in this country, and the Citizens Review Board that the anti-cop movement wants is another attack on law enforcement, said Noel Rosen, who is the founder of the Rally for Law Enforcement. So this debate, you have two extreme sides. One is anti-cop, one is pro-cop. Cops just want good cops.
Yes.
And that brings me back to why I don't believe in oversight, because you can have some people that are just so in love with cops.
You don't believe in civilian oversight.
We definitely believe
in oversight.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. A discipline review board, which all police agencies have.
Yeah.
And I like having a member of the community within that, like the Phoenix police, since I've been, you know, was a cop for 30 years, always had a civilian there. And they're almost always more lenient than police officers.
Oh, yeah. I would say
And I like that transparency. And that's why I think having police with a representative of the community, because ultimately it's the police chief's decision. And who does she work for? She works for a city council. So
you
can always make the argument there is civilian oversight.
If you got to trust the process from the investigators at the detective level through their supervisors all the way up through the top floor of your agency and on to the city council, the city manager, city and county prosecutors. I mean, there are a lot of people looking at this, but you know, the people who like to use the pretty words like civilian oversight on police are the ones who also go out and fail when they're offered, hey, come see what we do. And in the same, thank God, fake scenario training, they shoot and kill everybody. But then 2 weeks later, they're back out there going, you know, cops shouldn't have done this. You're not trained for it. You don't know what should or shouldn't happen. And the vast majority of cops who do things wrong, whether it be too much profanity all the way up to a shooting excessive that was not justified, they do get the appropriate punishment from 8 hours off all the way up to how many cops in the last couple of years have been arrested,
yes,
and put in jail for murder. It does happen, and I think trusting the process, there is nothing wrong with it. And now, I'm not a big fan of the civilian oversight. It's just a pretty word that a very few select people like to use around the country because, you know,
it's agenda-based.
Yeah, it is.
So now we could go into our next discussion. It has to do with Arizona sex offenders missing and unaccounted for. This is a local story, but it's probably very true to a lot of communities. We have registration laws for sex offenders, because as a rape detective, that's, if I had a professional tombstone, it'd be sex assault detective. That's where my passion lies. And Jason, homicide detective. And I think I can say that, and he's nodding to the affirmative.
Yeah, I don't think it would say successful missing registered sex offender on it. I'm so disturbed by even that headline, how you brought that in.
Yeah.
Missing.
Absolutely.
Registered. If you're registered, you can't be missing.
Well, what's happening is, in order for the registered sex offenders to get out of the prison, they have to be registered. We need to keep track of them because we understand as professionals in this arena that there is a recidivism like no other. They absolutely have this paraphilic desire to offend sexually, whether it be for power, control, whether it be for violence. They have this in them. It is like a shark when they taste blood for the first time. It's a feeding frenzy, and it's in them. It's who they are.
You're saying it's the one crime that cannot be rehabilitated.
100%. Yeah. 100% is my opinion based on my years of experience. And most of the experts in the field agree, which is why the registration laws occurred. So with an individual who does a certain type of crime that's enumerated within the sex crime statute within a particular community has to register. And by doing so, we know where they're at. So if there is a crime, a like type crime, we can look at them and see, was this within his MO? Did the suspect match that description? It gives us intelligence to keep the community safe. It's a great thing. I think everyone agrees with it. The problem is, what I have found is, a lot of sexual predators, when they're released from prison, when they're going through that registration process, they're able to list an intersection. And I say that again. They can list an intersection as their home because when they're being released, they've met their responsibility for their sentencing. And now they're being released. If there's no place that will allow them to live, they have no family conduit. They have no resources. Many of the apartment complexes and so forth won't allow a registered sex offender. They can screen them out based on felony convictions and so forth. They won't let them live there. So they don't.
Good.
It is good, but it's problematic because now they are living on the street. And we don't have accountability for them. We don't know. For example, there was a horrible rape, was attempt murder, really, with a veterinarian assistant. And they were watching this homeless guy acting weird. And instead of calling the police, they just kind of said, well, he's homeless, bless his heart. So even though he's acting weird, we're not going to call police. We don't want to harass him. And I understand that. The problem that a lot of people don't understand, though, is that within our homeless community, there are those who have violent potential. There's some that have behavioral mental health issues. And unfortunately, most definitely, there are those who are sexual predators. I'm sorry, but it's real. There are those, because they can register to an intersection, they are the homeless. And I want to give them resources because I want to, you know, put the community at a safe, make them safe. But they're out there. So when you see something out there that is of the homeless, we need to call police and be aware of this. The report, which was a local report here, ABC 15, which is a ABC affiliate here in the Valley of Phoenix, Arizona, has been tracking the number and learned that one of eight sex offenders in the state registry has an unknown address. I say again, one out of eight. That's more than 10%. They list cross streets or simply listed as absconded. And those absconded, by the way, are the criminal ones. Those are ones that they are no longer where they're supposed to be. There's a process in most registry within all the different states and so forth, municipalities, where you can go after them on warrants and so forth for absconding. They're not doing what they're supposed to do. But unfortunately, some of them are supposed to be at a certain address. And I hate to say address because it's an intersection and they're not there. You know, they're maybe at some type of place getting some resources, or maybe they are up to no good. So that is concerning when you look at, you know, more than 10%, we don't know where they're at. They're unaccounted for. And that is scary. And these are predators. Truly, I use that word with intention, because these are true predators that are sexually, their sex crimes are motivated by some type of bad wiring.
Right? Yeah.
A lot of it is control. They absolutely have control issues. They absolutely want to control people. A lot of them are anger. There's an anger rapist out there. You have violence. They just like creating violence. Basically, a sexual predator is that individual that has some type of sexual paraphilic desire to offend sexually, and they have that criminal capability of trespassing. So they're both a criminal and they have that deviant sexual desire, quite frankly. And that is a sexual predator. And once they offend, they will keep offending. We have to intervene because it's so... In fact, I'll give you a real quick story. One of the first sexual predators I came across was when I was a young officer in the 80s at a police precinct. I was last one out of a briefing, and my boss came up and said, "Hey, there's someone who wants to... confessed to molesting his son out in the lobby." I'm like, "Oh, thanks, boss."
Yeah.
So I go out to the lobby, bring him in. And again, I have no evidence of a crime, right? I just have him telling me he committed a crime. But he gives me detailed account of how he molested his son in a swimming pool and gives me nauseating, disgusting, in-depth details of this crime. And so when it was all done, I'm writing this all down and recorded him, thankfully, and we did convict him. And he came forward. This is him coming forward. And at the end of the interview, I just said, I got to ask, why did you do this? I mean, obviously you care about your son. You love your son because you're coming here to turn yourself in to protect your son. Why did you do this? And he said to me, there's no way you would ever understand because you're normal. But touching a young child consumes my every waking second.
Really?
When I go to work, I think about it. When I eat, I think about it. When I go to sleep, I think about it. When I go to play, when I go to church, everything I do, that consumes my thoughts. And that is scary. And that is a sign of a sexual predator.
Thank God he turned himself in.
Yeah. And a lot of them lead quiet lives of desperation. But unfortunately, once they offend, they will keep offending. And so it is concerning. And so really, I'm not here to bash the homeless. I'm really not. There's a lot of individuals that need resources and need our help. They've fallen through the cracks. God bless them. Let's get them help. But as a society, we need to be aware that there are people in the homeless community that are also bad people, just like any group of individuals. And if you see them doing something wrong, something suspicious, clearly anything to do with them touching themselves, you need to call the police. We need to protect the society as well as the homeless.
Yes. Awesome, buddy. That was a great cop talk segment. That was fun. Love to hear you get fired up a little bit for a change. All right, we'll be right back with heroic headlines and...
What?
Am I allowed to say my least favorite part of the show?
You can.
The stupid suspect stories?
That one doesn't bother him anymore.
No, because ever since...
the pee-pee doll.
Yes, the pee-pee doll is now... So the cat is gone and now the pee-pee doll, and God help you if you ever top that. So we'll be right back with those stories.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Batch Boys. We'll be back right after this.
I remember the moment.
I'll never forget that moment.
As long as I live.
As long as I live.
Several of us were working to rescue a family.
The house collapsed on top of the cellar door and trapped them.
We had to use Humvees and heavy machinery to move massive trees and debris.
We got them out.
We helped a lot of people out.
It felt good to know I could really make a difference.
Because I'm a citizen soldier in the National Guard.
Be there the moment your community needs you. Learn more at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Arizona National Guard. Aired by the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
Move over, AZ. Arizona's move over law requires you to move over or slow down when you drive past any vehicle pulled over with flashing lights. Remember, every vehicle, every time. Move over, AZ.
Sponsored by ADA in partnership with the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to Badge Boys with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Now, back to the Badge Boys.
You know, that was a great conversation we had about registered sex offenders, horrible individuals that have our sexual predators in our community. We talked about the civilian oversight, some heavy kind of topics. I think we need something light and happy and fun.
Yeah, lighten it up.
And heroic.
I can definitely lighten it up this week. And I would truly be surprised if people out there listening have not already heard this story, but I'm going to tell it and retell it because I just get a kick out of this. And the headline is, 102-year-old woman gets arrested to check getting arrested off of her bucket list. That is one of the greatest headlines ever. And I'm a big bucket list person, and I am never going to see 102. But what an incredible thing to, you know what, I want to get arrested. 102-year-old woman. And the story is, throughout her 102 years, Edie Sims has had a wide variety of experience in life. But until now, getting arrested was not one of them. Last Friday in St. Louis, Missouri, the woman finally got to check that experience off her bucket list when she was handcuffed, placed in the back of a police car that then drove her to a senior center where she was delivering handmade gifts to the residents. So she didn't actually get arrested. She didn't like go commit a crime to get this off her bucket list.
She was incarcerated.
So not only is she my hero just way to win at life.
Yeah.
But credit to those police officers who, like you said earlier, thought outside the box and were like, you know what? We'll do this. We'll do something for our community. We'll do something for you. We'll take the time out of our day. That's a heroic thing to do. I love when cops do that stuff. And good for her. She's going to live out the remainder of her days just knowing she'll never forget that memory. And that's what life should be about, is making memories. So
I love that.
I got to interject, though. We have to throw a shout out to our comedian cop, Don Steinmetz, because his comment to me pertaining to that was, it's Make-A-Wish for senior citizens.
Oh,
well, you know what? It actually is. We should do, you know what? We should do more of that because she deserves a good memory after 102 years. Imagine even think about the stuff that woman has seen.
I love to see that bucket list.
In her lifetime. the invention she's seen.
Right.
And, the poor thing has probably lost so many
dear friends.
You know, the circle of life that you want to go in order probably has not gone in order for her, like a lot of us experience. Yeah. But so she's just a beautiful soul, and credit to those cops. So, Darren.
That's so cute.
You know, it's
please
funny.
Bring us down.
I always try to get, you know, something related with a theme. And so far, we've been pretty much on target. You know, when he'll say something about some cops helping out, you know, the streets and stopping a drunk. And then I have like DUI stories. So, in my bag of tricks, I'm going to pull out patrol cars. This young lady at 102 years of age, 102 years young, is arrested because it's on her bucket list to be in a patrol car. That visual of being, you know, handcuffed and put in a patrol car. So our first story, a Phoenix man is in big trouble after he escaped from a patrol car. There's my patrol car connection. He escaped from a patrol car in handcuffs and ran from officers. So he is in handcuffs, just like our 102-year-old lady. He's in handcuffs, running from patrol car. 20-year-old Christopher Navarro ran from the officers and into a woman's home. He just barges in with his hands behind his back, running into the home. She told Navarro to leave, and he ends up running through the house. She said, quote, everybody's like home and relaxing, and don't expect these things to happen when this guy just came running in. So he runs around, and he ends up busting through her back door of her home. Thankfully, officers and a police canine eventually found him hiding in the bedroom inside a crib, inside the child's crib he is hiding. So he went from a
potential jail cell to another set of bars.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, wow. He loves bars. And thankfully, he's going to some more bars because he was arrested for burglary, escape, and resisting arrest. So he made the burglary into three felonies. So I like that. Keeping with the patrol car, I didn't have any other stupid suspect story in my bag of tricks. So what I'm going to do is tell you a story that occurred from Twisted But True. Occurred when I was a young officer in the 80s. Me and my partner went to a biker bar because there was a call of a fight outside. We ended up making an arrest. And the reason we made an arrest was because the suspect took a beer bottle, threw it, hit the other biker guy, because it was a gang. We had the Hells Angels on one side, we had the Dirty Dozen on the other side. I can't remember which was which, but the one of them ended up with a beer bottle to the side of the head, was thrown, it busted open on his face, completely opened up his cheek, where his cheek was lying like a trap door, hinged at the chin. I could see the inside of his mouth, the inner workings as he was talking about the fight. I could see his mouth and tongue and everything inside his mouth. It was bizarre. But we ended up making an arrest. It was a good deal. We put the suspect in a patrol car, and I'm doing the paperwork. My partner goes inside the biker bar. What we didn't know is that the entire biker bar took sides on this fight. Almost like 50-50 type scenario. So by the time my partner goes in, they're already upset at each other because one went to jail, others going to hospital. They go into a barroom brawl.
Oh.
Why, I'm writing my report, I hear on the radio, 906, officer needs help. And it's my partner who's literally probably about 10 feet away in that door, right? So what do? I jump on my patrol car, run into the bar. As I'm running into the bar, people are running out, and I'm getting thumped on. I'm getting so many cheap shots. They're hitting me left and right. I'm like a trout going upstream with this criminal element thumping on me. I finally get inside. We end up making like three arrests. My partner was absolutely down in the fight. There's three guys on him. I piled in. We had a pile. We end up making the arrest. Everything's fine. The dust settles. Everyone's gone, and then it dawns on me. I have a prisoner in the backseat of my car. I did not lock the doors. Oh. I go running in to save my partner, and I have nothing but criminals running out past my patrol car that's unlocked. What's the likelihood of him still being there? So I go outside, and my worst nightmare is fulfilled. Absolutely. He's gone. My door is open.
Oh,
he is gone. My door's wide open. Backseat door's open. I'm thinking, and I'm a rookie. I'm thinking, oh, my God, there goes my career.
I'm done.
And then I hear the voice. It says, thank you, officer. And he, my criminal, cuffed in the back, right? He walks past me, gets inside the car, and I shut the door. And I get inside, I'm thinking, what kind of miracle has played out here?
Right.
And I end up finding out why, the whole time I was doing the paperwork, all he kept talking about how he had to take a piss. I have to take a piss. I have to take a piss. And I said, I'm not going to let you take a piss behind a bush. Wait till we get to the jail.
Right.
So when I go running in, and he doesn't see that. So when one of the bad guys comes out and opens the door for him, he thinks I'm letting him out to take a piss.
Oh, my God.
And he got back in the car.
Yeah, exactly. It's like like Otis from the Andy Griffith Show. He comes in, lets himself in back into my backseat.
All right, guard. Stupid but respectful
and
criminal.
Lucky. I got lucky. No doubt about it.
That was the reverse Birch.
I love
right,
that.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Reversal.
Yeah, the Birch rule. Yeah.
I'd love
Birch
to talk
rule.
To that guy right now and be like, dude, do you remember this? That's a pretty funny story.
That was my stupid suspect story. Stupid, but thankfully, he had to take a piss.
Hey, if you got to go, you got to go.
And speaking of pissing, there's no correlation. There's no segue, but yeah, I need some inspiration.
No way to go. You know what? I'm just going to share with you something extremely cool that happened yesterday. And this is one of those that just made me look at my phone like, how does stuff like this happen? So I have an event coming up on Saturday night that happens once a year. It's pretty important. And take my son with me, who's 17 now, who's born after the accident. And it's a deal with the 100 Club, which we've had Angela Harrell on, and it's an event.
Wonderful,
incredible organization. It's an event to start after my retirement. So this is probably the 13th one. And anyway, so I've been traveling a lot. I've been busy. I'm horrible at keeping in touch. And so I shoot a text to two of the firefighters who are on my call. Okay. One of them lives in Park City, Utah. And I said, any chance you're in Phoenix right now? And he said, no, but I'll be there anyway. He's going to fly down for this. So that was pretty inspiring just after all these years. But after that, I text the engineer on my fire truck. Okay. I said, hey, do you happen to be free Saturday night? Would you like to sit at my table for this event? And she wrote back and said, oh my God, yes, I'm free. And I am currently sitting at the red light at 20th Street and Thomas, which is where,
oof, chills.
Of all times I text her, of all reasons, of all minutes, seconds, she's sitting at the red light. And I just stared at my phone, almost got tears in my eyes. And I'm like, you talk about living your life in a poetic fashion. That's just, those things are beautiful. So now I'm even 10 times more excited to just sit in that at that table, to look at their faces, and then to look at my son's face and just say, you know what? Everything is okay.
Serendipity.
And it's a beautiful thing. You got to find inspiration every day. And I found it yesterday. It's carried through today. And of course, just doing this show with you guys.
Love you.
God, I love Wednesdays. I love Wednesdays. So awesome. Thank you, everybody. And we will do it again next week. Take care.
Batch Boys. Thanks for listening to Batch Boys. Stories, insights, guests, and true blue humor with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Batch Boys, heard weekly and worldwide on Star Worldwide Networks and all mobile devices. Batch Boys.